You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, this is Coyle Neal, and welcome to another very occasional episode of the City of Man podcast. Joining me today is Nathan Gilmore, English teacher at North Gwinnett High School. Nathan, how are you doing?
I am doing well, and listeners, in case you're wondering, you know, where we went between January and May, Coyle had to take over some courses from a colleague who's having some medical issues, so his schedule got very busy. I, as usual, overestimated myself and thought that I could finish out a year of high school and still keep a full podcasting schedule, and that turned out not to be the case. So we're hoping that here in the summer we can give you a few episodes, you know, during this election year, presidential election year, I should say. Most years are election years in some sense, and, you know, give you some more City of Man episodes, and then hopefully going forward, Coyle's colleagues will stay healthy. I'll manage my time better, and you'll hear more City of Man. So, Coyle?
But we promise nothing.
Yeah, we promise nothing, but we have aspirations, great aspirations. Coyle, how have you been doing?
Good. Like you said, it's been a busy semester. I got to take on a class that I had never taught before on about 3 days' notice, and a class that I had taught before also on 3 days' notice, but that I wasn't planning to teach. So
right.
It was definitely a busy semester, and then there were a lot of things going on that just kind of ground things to the halt in the non-essential world, and I love podcasting, but it's definitely the non-essential world.
Oh, it's so a hobby, it was, to be sure.
Even though you just promised more episodes, I am basically out the entire month of June, so we might be super active in July. We'll have to see.
Right. While we are on, though, you know, we should note that the Christian Feminist Podcast continues to soldier on, continues to put out regular content, unlike the rest of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Recently, they've done episodes on the Gospel of Mark and on the streaming series, The Last of Us. Before They Were Live has also been doing episodes on Grimm Brothers Tales, which are very interesting to listen to, and you ought to go have a listen. And we should have a couple more Christian Humanist Profiles episodes here in the next few weeks. So the network is once again, you know, lurching to a slow start again. You know, we're hoping that this summer we can get some movement going in general. Trying to think, Coyle, is there any other network news that we should note?
If there is, you would be the one to know it, not me.
Right. Well, anyway, listeners, I had this idea for a, you know, right now the idea is a trilogy of episodes called the Political What If. And, you know, what I presented to Coyle was, you know, a lot of times when I, as sort of an amateur who is interested in, you know, political matters, but, you know, I don't necessarily have a lot of formal education. I'd have some, you know, reading and some self-teaching. But when I hear podcasts and other media talk about, especially the presidential election years, there's sort of a recurring list of things that, you know, people bring up as complicating the electoral process. So the first of those episodes today is going to have to do with the primary process. So, you know, as listeners in the States no doubt find inescapable, but just in case we have listeners from elsewhere that need a little background, in a presidential election cycle, and usually in the year of the presidential election, so every 4 years, there will be a series of local events, I'll call them that, leading up to the general election in November, in which different states appoint delegates to elect or to select, I'll say select rather than elect, and Coyle's going to correct all of my terminology here in a moment, to select candidates from the two major parties and then presumably from other parties as well, although, you know, the American Solidarity Party, you know, usually just tells us who it is, you know, and then we just kind of say, yeah, that's who I'll vote for instead of those other bozos. But during that process, the states appoint delegates until one of the candidates has enough delegates to, you know, become the nominee for the party. So here in 2024, all of this happened over the course of, you know, January, February. I think one of them might have extended into March, but I might be remembering that wrong. Until Donald Trump and Joe Biden had enough delegates to become the nominees for the Republican and Democratic parties. So, Coyle, I mean, you know, before we get into, you know, the what if, which I'll reveal here in a moment, I know that open primaries started up in the second half of the 20th century, but how formal were the party events before then? I know the phrase smoke-filled room gets thrown around when folks talk about the two major parties before the 60s, but what documentary record do we have of how parties chose their candidates before general primaries?
Yeah, so primaries are, I guess we should say, just to clarify some of the language here, and this, listeners, I apologize, I did not name these. This is where the terms get a little weird. The big general catch-all term is the primary, right? This is the season when each party holds internal elections to choose who their candidate for president is going to be, plus their candidates for governor and Congress and mayor. I mean, it's everything is chosen through a primary. It's basically an internal tool that each of the political parties use. All of the political parties, it doesn't matter, even the, like you said, the minor third parties also have versions of this. Although what that specifically looks like for them will be a little different. Within that big sort of umbrella category of primaries, the two subcategories are the primary and the caucus. So the primary form of primary, again, sorry, listener, is just an election. You show up on whatever day your state and party have agreed is going to be the primary election day, and you cast your paper ballot, and that's the primary. It is minor and unobtrusive, and people tend to like that because you just show up and vote like it's any other election.
Right. Georgia's primary, as we record, was just last week, and I went in and voted in the nonpartisan one, which means I was done in about 15 seconds.
Yep. Well, even if you'd voted in the partisan one, you probably would have been done, you know, 15 seconds because it's the candidates on your party's ballot. Same thing in Missouri. Back when we had presidential primaries, you would say, I want the Republican ballot, or I want the Democrat ballot, or I want the, you know, whatever libertarian ballot. Mm-hmm. And they would hand you that and you'd vote for who you wanted to be the presidential candidate for that party. And then the within that, so to further zoom in, there are open primaries and closed primaries. Open primaries are, you don't have to declare your party beforehand. You don't have to be a member of the party. You can just say, I want to be Republican or I want to be Democrat, and they decide that at the poll. The closed primaries, you must be registered as a member of the party in advance in order to vote in the party's primary. So if you show up at the polls and you're not listed as a Republican, you don't get to vote in the Republican primary. So that's a state-by-state distinction.
Right. And again, just to give the, you know, the Georgia instance, you know, I voted in both Democratic and Republican primaries here in Georgia, as well as, you know, selected nonpartisan. And, you know, it really just kind of depended on, you know, which race was more interesting to me in a given year. There were no questions. I just, you know, they said, which ballot do you want? Once I said, they handed it to me and I went and did my thing.
Yep. And that's any state with a open primary, that's going to be the approach. And even the closed primaries, they'll already have your name down. That's the only difference there. You don't get to pick which one. The process looks exactly the same otherwise. Mm-hmm. The caucus is a little more complicated. It's usually a day-long event, so you have to sort of be willing to invest. Obviously, participation is going to be significantly lower when states have a caucus. It's not always a full day, but it's usually a fairly intensive thing. You will show up at a building that is set aside as your caucus. Each candidate will have a room designated for them, so colleges get used a lot, schools, churches, any building that has lots of, you know, discrete rooms in it is going to be fair game for this, especially if you can get it on empty on a Saturday. Each candidate will have a room. There'll be the from 2020, there'll be the Joe Biden room and the Elizabeth Warren room and the Bernie Sanders room for the Democratic caucus. And then you, as the caucus goer, will go to each room and they'll make their pitch and try to convince you that, you know, you should vote for Biden or you should vote for Buttigieg or whatever. And then at a predetermined time, a bell will ring or an alarm will sound or something, and you will go to the room of the candidate you've decided to support. And whoever has the most people in their room at the end of the day wins.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sort of the big umbrella things. Both of those are sort of 20th century innovations. Now, obviously, elections existed before that, so that the primary format existed prior to the structure of it existed prior to the parties using them, and then the caucus approach has been used forever in the United States as well. It goes back to colonial era elections up in New England, in the Boston area. They invented caucusing because it was the name that shipbuilders used for applying caulk to the ships to keep them sealed.
So it has nothing to do with the mountain range.
Nope, nothing to do with the mountain range. Everything to do with, they would go down and get all these, you know, day laborers and bring them up and make them participate in the political process, and then they go back to their jobs. So that's the origin. It's been around forever, but at the beginning of the 20th century, there's this movement coming out of the progressive world, the sort of the populist party gets mm-hmm. absorbed into the Democratic Party, and part of what they decide to do is to make their appeal more broad. They want to have a candidate that will be generally acceptable to the American people, and the idea is the old way of choosing candidates is now failing at that, so we want someone who's more electable. So at the beginning of the 20th century, political parties start to add in primaries. By the time you get to the 1970s, the two major parties are basically choosing their candidates only using primaries. There's a couple of exceptions here and there. So George McGovern's vice presidential candidate was picked at a convention because his previous vice presidential candidate was revealed to have undergone electroshock therapy for some psychological issues that he had. So they dumped him from the ticket and then had to pick one at the convention. So there are exceptions. Third parties still, and I guess I should say, what were they doing before that instead, which was your original question, right?
Yes.
Before primaries were the tool that parties were using, candidates were chosen at conventions. Mm-hmm. So the big national meeting of the Republicans, the big national meeting of the Democrats, the big national meeting of the Whigs, that's where you get the sort of smoke-filled room idea. Although that's not exactly accurate. That's the sort of talk radio stereotype. Right. The reality is there were, you know, hundreds of people at these. They were not closed sessions. The media was there. There were big debates and arguments, and you'd have, you know, candidates proposed and day long speeches given in support of this candidate or that candidate. My favorite story of these is at the I think this was the 1880 Republican convention. James Garfield was a senator and had been asked to nominate some other guy, and I don't remember who the other guy was, but he stood up and he gives this two-hour-long speech that's just this amazing speech about how this other guy is going to be the most awesome president ever. And at this point, the convention had been going for several days, and they'd had several ballots cast, and no one had come out with a majority. So Garfield, this is supposed to be the sort of slam dunk for this guy. They have this popular senator. Who had never wanted to be a senator. Garfield had been a college president and kind of dragged out of his college and made to be senator. So Garfield gives this speech, and at the end of it, the big climax is he asks kind of, who do we want to be the next president of the United States? And the people in the room are supposed to say whatever this guy's name was. And someone at the back of the room shouts, we want Garfield. And the entire room starts chanting, we want Garfield, we want Garfield, we want Garfield. And Garfield is down front going, no, I absolutely don't want, I just want to go back to my college. I don't want to be involved in government anymore. The convention votes, and Garfield gets the nomination. And he not only refuses to campaign because which isn't a big deal then, it's not acceptable for presidents to campaign yet, but he refuses to participate in any way, shape, or form in the process. So he goes back to his place in Ohio and says, "Hey, I will be runs a front porch campaign. I'll be on my front porch a couple hours every afternoon. If any journalists want to take the 20-minute horseback ride from town to to my house, I'll answer questions." People love it. I mean, he becomes wildly popular, wins in this landslide, and then gets assassinated a couple of years into his term. So that's what conventions do, right? They used to pick the president. Now, again, the idea being we want someone who is more generally acceptable, not just to the people who are excited enough about the party to spend several days at a national convention. We want to know what the actual voters think.
And I've got one more follow-up on this before we turn the corner. A lot of times, again, in, you know, podcasts and in, you know, sort of popular political writing, the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention is sort of lifted up as a turning point in the way that we do primaries.
Sure.
How important was it, and how much is that a legend that's grown up around the 68 convention?
So the 68 convention, I will admit, I don't know as much about the turning point. I think it's the last time, I should have looked this up beforehand. I think it's the last time a presidential candidate was directly chosen by the convention.
Right.
I think. More importantly, it is the last convention where sort of mass chaos descends. There's rioting in the streets outside. The police and the National Guard are tear gassing all of these Vietnam protesters. The tear gas works its way into the hotel where all the convention delegates are staying. So you have, you know, United States senators being tear gassed by the National Guard. You have
the good old days.
The national media is there, so all of this is done on live television. Everyone's watching at this point.
Uh-huh.
The police are, you know, beating down these protesting hippies. Protesting hippies are, you know, throwing rocks and stuff at the police. I mean, it's this mass chaos in Chicago. So whatever you think of any convention that happened since then, none of them are as bad as the 1968
right.
one. Not more importantly, but equally important, and there's a great Netflix documentary about this called Best of Enemies. ABC hired two pundits to sort of talk their way through the two conventions that year. William F. Buckley was the first person they approached, and he was like, "Yeah, I'll do it. I will debate absolutely anyone except Gore Vidal." So ABC went to Gore Vidal. So you can go back and you can watch these two. And I mean, at one point.
Fans of the Christian Humanist Radio Network, Danny Anderson just adores this debate between Buckley and Vidal.
Oh, yeah, it's great. I mean, at one point, Vidal calls Buckley a fascist. At one point, Buckley threatens to, you know, punch him in his mouth. It is fantastic. all of this on live TV, right? All of this is going on in real time. So, yes, 68 is certainly the convention to watch in kind of living memory.
Okay.
Not your or my living memory, but
right,
still.
Right. America's living memory.
Right.
Sure. So here's my next question. I mean, you know, it's well noted that, you know, the Constitution itself doesn't mention political parties, much less political primaries. So, I mean, what authority structure actually keeps the primaries going from election cycle to election cycle? Is it the parties themselves? Are there state laws governing these things? You know, there's a lot of talk this year because South Carolina, rather than New Hampshire, became the first primary for the Democratic National Convention. You know, who that makes the rules and maintains the rules that keeps these primaries going?
Yeah, so ultimately this is party stuff. There are state laws that govern the application of them, but it's parties decide this. They are not obligated to use primaries, so the Libertarian Party convention just happened last week. Mm-hmm. By the time this drops, it will probably be 2 weeks ago. They did not have primaries this year. They just picked their candidate at the convention. Donald Trump showed up and gave a speech and made the case that it should be him, and they booed him off the stage. He
I did not know that. That's wonderful.
Yeah, he rightly noted that if everyone in 2020 who had voted Libertarian had voted for him, he would have won. Would all of those Libertarians have voted for him if they had not voted Libertarian? I have no idea. But he made that case. RFK Jr., I think, showed up. I don't know that he was allowed to give a speech. I'm not sure about that. He was also there trying to make the case that, hey, they should make him the candidate. And they I don't know if they booed him off the stage because I don't know if they gave him the stage. But they did not make him. They picked some guy whose name I don't remember. Chase something or other. Again, it was at the convention. There was no way to know who the candidate was going to be moving into that because they hadn't picked one and they just said, we're going to do this here. Back when the no labels movement was theoretically going to be doing something or other, they had also said they were going to hold a convention and pick their candidate before they kind of imploded and decided not to. I don't know about the Green Party or the Constitution Party or the American Solidarity Party. I assume they're also doing conventions. I don't know.
Right. Right.
I only know the Libertarians because they because Trump was at it and it was news. So
apparently I should have followed this because this sounds like all kinds of fun.
Oh yeah, you should go watch the clip. It's pretty glorious. At one point he's like, "I guess you guys are just like losing," or something to that effect. A very Trump line. So no party has to do it. It's a choice that they're making. Whether it's a good choice or not, of course, that's a different conversation. I tend to be pretty anti-populist, so I'd go back to the smoke-filled rooms. I would say, look at the candidates we've been getting. Maybe there's something to be said for letting the party elites choose it. But no party's going to do that, right? Just realistically, no party wants to look like the party that doesn't care what you and I think. If anything, we've seen a move in the other direction. So with occasional exceptions, caucuses have become a thing, are increasingly a thing of the past. There are exceptions. Missouri actually switched over to a caucus with its presidential primary. So we split our primary in half. The presidential primary now takes place in March and is a caucus. The primary for everyone else is in August, and it's still a vote. You show up and cast your ballot at the.
Well, that's actually a pretty good segue into the what if part of this, because one of the things I've been pondering, and this is largely based on, you know, speculations that I've heard on television and on podcasts and other places, people love to gripe about the disconnect between what the primary electorate wants and what the larger voting population is willing to vote for. And, you know, I mean, from what I hear and, you know, from what I understand them to be saying, I mean, it seems like a pretty reasonable case. So, you know, I think that, you know, if I think both of the parties would have to, you know, sort of do a simultaneous plunge on this and do away with direct primaries. So let's, for the sake of, you know, this argument, let's stipulate that they took that dual plunge. I think that doing away with direct primaries could potentially give us some legislators that actually pass laws. And some executives who might actually enforce laws rather than, you know, going in with a big slate of executive orders. And both of these ultimately might be better than legislators who mainly posture for the camera and executives who come in with, you know, their executive orders ready to roll. Now, I know that, you know, you would probably derive some enjoyment from refusing to speculate and leaving me high and dry the way Michael Farmer used to do on the Christian Humanist podcast, but don't be that way. Do you think that the quality of these candidates would improve if we took the direct primary system out of this process?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the question is the damage already done?
Sure. Right? That's what
I'm. If we got rid of the tool we have now, we still have national conventions, we still have state conventions, we still have local conventions. The party still gathers, right? Sure. So the older vehicle is still in place, and it is. It is the formal means of nomination still, right? You are not the Democratic candidate until the Democratic National Convention meets.
Right.
You're not the Republican candidate until the Republican National Convention meets. So theoretically, that apparatus is still
there. Right. So people still talk about presumptive nominees until the conventions happen.
Yep. So and in 2016, there was talk about convention hijinks to keep Trump from being the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
There was talk in 2020 about convention hijinks to keep Biden from being the nominee. Nothing happened, obviously, in either case, in part, not because any Republican was like, we are excited about Donald Trump in 2016, or not because any Democrat thought they were super excited about Joe Biden in 2020, just because they were so terrified of what would happen if they were seen to be going against the will of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but again, assuming that we start to rely on that extant apparatus, instead of on the primary elections that we've got, would we get better candidates? And I genuinely don't know. I'd love to be able to say yes. I'd love to just say yeah. Mm-hmm. We would. The issue is there's still that general election coming up, and the party leadership is still going to be saying we want to win that. It doesn't matter if we pick a guy that's faithful to the party if he loses. We want the person who is most electable. So. We're going to be doing sort of polls. We're going to be doing social media research. We're going to be doing all of the stuff to try to figure out. It might still be Donald Trump and Joe Biden, right? That still might be what we settle on. because those are what our numbers keep coming back, right? We keep doing the social science data and coming back with these two names.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, like, I'm not refusing. I'm just saying I don't know.
Right, right.
I don't know because it's still going to be the desire to get the same outcome.
Well, and I guess here's why this question fascinates me, because another term that gets thrown around a lot, especially in podcasts, but also I've heard it, you know, thrown around on TV, is generic Republican and generic Democrat, right? And right. It seems like that if either party could come up with generic Republican or generic Democrat, they would be able to run away with the presidential election, because generic Republican beats Joe Biden every time and generic Democrat beats Donald Trump every time. But with the particular baggage that the actual 2024 candidates bring to this thing, I mean, it seems like, you know, sort of the negative impulse, you know, I don't want that guy to be in the White House, is largely what's driving this thing. But I mean, if you paired that with, you know, some positive movement, you know, the kind that you saw with, I mean, even within, you know, our recent memory, you know, candidates like Barack Obama or candidates like Ronald Reagan, I mean, you know, even if you got a fraction of that, that would be enough to, you know, tilt the balance. So, I mean, you know, would the parties have the tools to actually get some positive momentum if they weren't relying on, you know, the most dedicated and perhaps the most sheltered partisans, the ones who tend to show up for caucuses and primaries.
Yeah, I mean, what you're working against there, right, is the last two elections.
Yeah.
So in 2020, the Democrats ran a generic Democrat and he won. So I mean, there is solid evidence on from their perspective that, hey, this is the way to go. Let's stick with what we know works. So we know Joe Biden can beat Donald Trump, so let's stick with him.
Right, right.
Donald Trump, obviously, and Ed and I did an episode back in 2016 on Trump, and I have no memory of what I said there.
Well, there's so much to say, but go ahead.
Well, I think we did it fairly early too. I think we did it right around Super Tuesday. So I would imagine that I said something to the effect of this guy is an outlier and he has no chance of winning, because that's what everyone was saying.
Sure. I was saying that now, back in 2016.
Yeah, well, now 8 years down the road, I think I've kind of changed my tune a little bit, and I think he might be average Republican. Now, that's perhaps a condemnation of the Republican Party, and maybe that's the result of him just being around for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it may be that Donald Trump is generic Republican these days. So, again, he won in 2016. So maybe the logic is, well, he'll win again. And to some extent, we know that because Nikki Haley, if Donald Trump was not generic Republican, Nikki Haley certainly was.
Right, right.
And she didn't beat him.
Right.
She didn't beat him among
primary voters, though.
Well, she had. So even for the primary back in 2016, all of the other candidates said variations on, you know, if we had just had the chance to go head to head against Trump, we would have won.
Right? Sure, sure.
Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush and John Kasich and all of these guys said, hey, you know, if it was just me and him, I'd have wiped the floor with him. But the rest of us, you know, normal candidates divided things out.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what cost us. Well, Haley got that.
Right. Right?
Haley had the chance to go head to head with Trump and she still didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, she is kind of older school normal Republican, but I think Trump's probably new generic Republican.
Okay, okay.
And what we have to look forward to moving ahead.
Okay, that's very depressing. But yep. Yeah, so I mean, you know, that turns me to, you know, more of a philosophical question, and that is, I mean, you know, the impulse behind public primaries, and I'll use those rather than open primaries because you distinguish nicely between open and closed primaries in the terminology there. But, you know, one of the arguments in favor of public primaries that you've already stated is that they reflect the will of the people, right? You know, to go away from them would be to take the privilege from the people to choose the candidates for the party. Okay. On the other hand, you know, again, one of the arguments that one hears most frequently is that the people who actually vote in primaries are a sliver of the population, and that, you know, the big wigs in the party, I think that's a technical term too, but the big wigs in the party, they would be more apt to choose candidates who are more appealing in November, right? Now, obviously, 2020, I mean, kind of, I won't say kind of, 2020 complicates this radically because we had record voter turnout in 2020. We also had a giant part of the U.S. population that hadn't been out of the house for several months. So, of course, they're going to turn up on Election Day. And also, we had a record early voting apparatus. So, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things to talk about there. But I guess here's my question. I mean, you know, if you've got a system that de facto relies on, you know, a sliver of the population to choose these candidates, is that fundamentally democratic because it gives everyone the opportunity, or is it fundamentally anti-democratic in that it's a sliver of the population making the choice? And obviously the answer is going to be a mix of the two, but, and go ahead, take a run.
As you know, it's perfectly democratic. As long as there are no intentional barriers to keeping people from voting who should be voting, perfectly democratic, right? Turnout has always been a problem in democracies. So there were rules in ancient Athens about attending the assembly on assembly days.
Right.
And they still couldn't get people to show up. At one point,
yeah, Athens, the legend is that's the origin of the phrase roped into something, right? Is that they would actually bring ropes out into the public square and bring people in using a rope to vote.
So Athens owned there were state slaves, these Scythian slaves, that would go out on election day with dyed ropes, and they'd go through the marketplace, they'd stand on either side of the marketplace and do a big sweep through with the ropes, and if you got red dye on your toga, they fined you for not being down at the assembly.
Right.
Again, it's always been a problem. Participation is notoriously low in democratic societies. And that's fine. I think participation is too high, but I'm a cranky old man. There's a lot of people out there voting who have no business picking up a ballot, but that's a conversation for another day. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're not, you know, physically keeping people away from the polls or putting barriers in place that shouldn't be there, I mean, there should be some kind of minimal barrier, but as long as it's just a minimal barrier, no, there's I don't think there's anything anti-democratic. I mean, what do you think? Do you think that we have a structurally anti-democratic society here because of the
problem? Well, like I said, I mean, I'm conflicted about it just because, you know, empirically, you know, I mean, there is a segment of the voting population, I happen not to be part of it, that doesn't show up for primaries. And I mean, it is a gigantic segment of the population. So, I mean, you know, de facto, empirically, you know, it is a small number of people. I happen to be among that small number of people, so I guess I shouldn't complain too loudly, that actually picks these candidates, right? I also live in Georgia, so there's been exactly one presidential cycle where my vote has been relevant in the primary, and that was 2016, ironically enough. But, you know, you're right. I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, the actual access to that ability, I mean, it is completely open to anyone who shows up on that day. So, you know, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, I've always wrestled with this. And I mean, you know, it might just be that I have been overthinking it my entire adult life. But, you know, the distinction that we make between things that are unimpeded on one hand and things that are freely chosen on the other hand. And I guess the fact that no one makes that distinction is what troubles me, because if things happen a certain way every time, I wonder how free they actually are. I guess I expect free things also to happen a little bit more randomly and a little bit less predictably.
Yeah, and obviously there are things that governments could do to increase participation, right? So I like the caucus model. I hope states that have it keep it. But I will admit that it does depress participation.
So we
did our first presidential caucus this year in Missouri, and there were in the Republican caucus. I live in a city of about 10,000 people. For a primary, the turnout's usually about 10%. In previous years, about 1,000 people would show up and vote in a primary, which is pretty good for a town our size. At this particular presidential caucus, I think there were 110 people in the room.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's obviously only 10% of what there used to be. Now, there will be more when they do the rest of the primary in August, but that does affect participation. And they were very, how can I put this generously? They were very demographically unique.
Yes.
I was, if I wasn't the youngest person in the room, I was pretty close to it.
Right.
I was definitely part of the young crowd. Mm-hmm. And vast majority of the people in the room were over 60.
Right.
So.
Well, and there, I think, and this is only tangentially related to it, but it spurred this thought that I've had before that, you know, there's part of me, and this is probably because I've spent my adult life teaching rhetoric, there's part of me that would prefer a politics that's based on changing people's minds rather than a politics that's based on increasing voter turnout. And, sure. You know, the fact that, you know, I mean, fear and anger, which, you know, Boethius calls famously the tools of tyrants, you know, fear and anger are what increase voter turnout, and therefore that's what, you know, gets your guy into the House of Representatives. That's what gets your guy into the White House. That's what gets your guy into places of power. I feel like I would prefer something that was more based on, you know, rational deliberation. I'm not sure that's even possible, you know, given mass media, given, you know, and it might predate mass media. I mean, you just noted that this is a problem even in 5th century BC Athens.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, there's something. And again, it's probably just kind of my own idealism when it comes to public life that would prefer a politics, you know, where we're trying to change each other's minds rather than a politics where we're trying to get people scared and angry enough to show up on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, I would settle for that change in Congress.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but as long as we don't have that with the American people, we're not going to get that in government either.
Sure, sure. So, yeah.
So a government that deliberates and
right.
makes rational arguments would be sufficient.
So to loop it back to the what if, I mean, as far as you can tell, I mean, you know, changing the machinery of nominating candidates wouldn't move that either direction.
I mean, changing machinery does have impacts.
Okay.
It does impact. Uh-huh. So again, we changed over to a caucus and it meant only 1% of the population participated, right? That is a change.
Yeah.
And it did affect what people do. So it might be that if a party genuinely said two things, like genuinely said, hey, we're choosing this at conventions.
Uh-huh.
And second, we're going to try to pick responsible candidates.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? We're going to try to pick someone who will be a good president, regardless of whether they're popular.
Okay.
Maybe. I mean, wouldn't hurt to try. Like, it's not going to be worse.
Right.
So,
but
at which point, you know, of course it could be worse. The voice in the back of my head's like, really? Is that what you want to say?
Yeah. And that tendency you and I both have is that, you know, we are the people who always say, you know, in the face of you have nothing to lose but your chains, we say, yeah, actually, I can think of four or five without thinking very long.
They're pretty nice chains too. So you know, that's
well, here's where you know, the second part of my what if, my hunch is, and I mean this goes back to something you said earlier, given the low voter turnout that I hear about from year to year, with the exception of 2020 that we talked about, my guess would be that if the relevant authorities in the two big parties said that the first official party event in 2028 is going to be the convention, that we'd have riots in the days following because Americans seem to be in the mood to riot lately. But after that, I mean, let's say 2036, 2040, assuming the riots didn't get so bad that, you know, history wrote a very different tale, I would guess that we'd be down to the strongly worded think pieces by then. And by the time my kids have grandkids, nobody would miss public primaries. Do you think that ship has already sailed, or, I mean, how hard would it be to break the public primary habit?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this. On the one hand, I don't think anyone would care. Like, I don't think people care about primaries. People care about politics, but not that much. Like, it's something that's easy to gripe about. But again, if you look at even voter turnout in the general election is still usually under 50%.
Sure.
Right. It's just not on the radar of most Americans. And that's a good thing. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Now, I think that becomes less true the farther down the chain you go. You should care about your local government. You should care about your county and your state government. But national level, who cares who the president is? To quote Bill Burr, he's not going to buy your groceries. You're never going to meet him. It doesn't matter.
Right.
So in that sense, no, I don't think anyone would care if they announced that there will be no presidential primaries, in 2028. By the time 2028 rolls around, like you said, it just wouldn't matter. Now, with that said, the point where I hesitate a little bit is that something that politicians could use to whip up people into a frenzy and get them out to vote or to cause ruckuses at conventions? Maybe. I don't think it's an outrage there's no primary is a good Twitter slogan, or X slogan, I guess.
Right.
But the powerful are keeping you from getting your way is always a powerful slogan.
Sure, right? Sure.
That's always something that you can say. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I don't know. It depends on whether you have demagogues who are enterprising enough to make that an issue, and we probably do.
Right. And someone could come up with a slogan. You and I trying to come up with it in 10 seconds.
Sure.
We don't even have paid staff.
Yeah.
Because like I said, if you look at, the proportion of the population, like you said, that even shows up to vote, it's not that big. If you look at the proportion of the population that shows up for a primary, it's even smaller. And for a caucus, like you just noted, even smaller than that. So, I think the question would be, of that sliver, what portion of them would be ready and willing to, make trouble, whether that takes the form of riots, whether that takes the form of some other kind of action that I'm not imagining.
Well, and here's, I think this is sort of the good-ish news. That sliver is the sliver that it's actually going to be easy to convince it's okay for the party, right? If you just make the case that this is, the party, this will be better for the Republicans or better for the Democrats to get away from this. If you can actually make the case, the party diehards aren't going to be the people upset about it.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
It's going to be the people who think they're going to lose because of it.
Okay.
That's going to be one group who are going to be upset. And the people who think they're going to lose and can't see how this might mean a win down the road.
Right.
That's going to be your up in arms or the people who are feeling that they are left out. The people who are feeling that they have lost a voice that they used to have, or now don't have access to a voice, even if they never used it before. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, those are the people who are going to be upset. The party diehards, it's just usually not them who are out doing the rioting.
Okay.
It's not the blue blooded Democrats or the red blooded Republicans who are out chucking bricks at windows. It's the sort of fringes of the movements that only show up occasionally. That's where you run into trouble. As we're seeing with as the January 6th prosecutions are ongoing, right?
Yeah.
It's not a bunch of Republican delegates who are there
right,
at the Capitol,
right.
Breaking into things. It's very much the sort of hangers on, the drones, if we're using Plato's language, who are there causing problems.
Right. And likewise, the people who spoke up first when the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for not Menachem Begin.
Netanyahu.
I really should know who the Prime Minister of Israel is. But, when the International Criminal Court, dropped that arrest warrant, the first person to say, yeah, no, we're not doing that was Joe Biden. So, the actual head of the party says, no, we're not going that direction. So, yeah, I think you got some valid points there. So let me ask you this kind of as a, and this is going to be a fairly brief episode, and I think that's all right. But, as far as, consequences of this that I'm not anticipating, would there be any other fallout that you would anticipate if the major parties went away from public primaries and went back to a convention as the site of nomination or went to a different system that, you know, still wasn't public primaries but was something else.
Yeah, and there are alternatives. So ranked choice primaries, which again is not, I don't know if you would count that as something else or not, right? It's still people voting, but it's a different
method. Yeah, and I think the movement I have in mind is, you know, people who are party operatives who actually think about how to win elections, actually choosing the candidates.
So just back to that older model.
Yeah, yeah.
Back to the party faithful choosing it. Or there's actually an even older model, kind of pre 1830s, 1820s,
okay.
Where just Congress picked the candidates. Like the members of the parties in Congress got together and picked their presidential candidates that way. So, not quite the British model of Parliament picking the Prime Minister, but closer to that than our more active parties. So there are other options. I think that the thing you're going to run into is the same claim we hear that you and I will be talking about when we talk about the Electoral College, mm-hmm. right? This is undemocratic. You're just not going to get away from that. Anything that makes it less democratic is going to cause people to push back against it.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the changes that the Supreme Court has been wrangling with over districting,
right?
It has everything to do with whether or not these districts are genuinely representative. Are they suppressing votes? Are they keeping people from being able to participate in the system? Those are all the questions that are being asked.
Right.
Is it democratic or is it not democratic? Small d democratic or not democratic? And this would be a step away from that in the minds of the American people. Now, I would say, well, the actual election, and this is the thing that it's important to remember. Primaries are just internal party operations. Mm-hmm. They're not really elections.
Right.
I know we cast a ballot and it looks the same.
Right. So in the broad sense of the term, someone is elected in the sense that someone is chosen, but it's not an election in the way that the Constitution writes about elections.
Right. It's not that thing that we do on the first Tuesday following the first Monday of November of every even numbered year.
Right.
It's not that. It's
except for Virginia, and I can't figure out Virginia.
No, Virginia. It should still be the same day. They may.
Yeah, but they keep having those odd number elections.
Oh yeah. So state elections are different, right? So
yeah, I know. I'm joking. Keep rocking.
So because of that, it's not really. You're not really undermining democracy if you get rid of it. You're not eliminating the actual election, but that's not how we think, right? That's just not how our minds work.
Right.
So, I don't see a practical way to undo that. Again, some states have moved from a primary to a caucus, which is a step in that mm-hmm. direction. It is almost entirely tied to whether or not the current candidate thinks it'll be better for him in the next election. So that's what happened in Missouri. Okay, the Trump campaign basically said this will be better for us.
So there's very little principle and a lot of tactics.
And basically that was without regard to what's that going to mean for 10 years from now? What's that going to mean for 20 years from now? No concern for that.
It's a Janet Jackson politics. Yep. What have you done for me lately?
What is going to be best for Joe Biden in 2024? Right, that's been the calculus.
Okay.
And what is at some point they'll start thinking 2028, but that's tomorrow's problem. That's not Joe Biden's problem. That's not Donald Trump's problem. That's someone else's problem.
Right. And it's bizarre because in a lot of things I think that the ancients have a lot to teach us. But when the ancients say that the old will have a broader perspective, they'll be able to see, long-term consequences better than the young. These last few years of American politics make me think, you guys swung and missed on that one.
Well, to be fair, I don't think it's either Biden or Trump that are doing. They're approving it insofar as they find out about it, if anyone even
point
runs
taken,
it by
point
them.
Taken.
But this is a party decision, not a Trump or Biden decision.
Right. That's true enough. I still get suspicious.
sure.
Well, at any rate, Coyle, is there anything else that you'd want to add to this conversation about the primaries before we preview our next episode and wrap up?
No, I would encourage our listeners. So look into what your party is doing in your area. So often, mm-hmm. and again, I'm sorry about the terminology here. Often states will have both a primary and a caucus. There'll be one that's sort of the general thing where you're choosing the candidate, and then your party will have like an internal meeting for just the members. I would actually encourage you to go to both of those, even if just in your mm-hmm. local area. I know that, you know, going to the state one can be a big ask sometimes, but going to your local one, they usually hold them on Saturdays so people can go and just sort of see what's going on, pay attention to what's being said there. See who's showing up. You're going to know people at it if you live in a small community. And if you don't live in a small community, then you should know the people who are showing up at your local caucus or primary if it's
right,
open.
Right.
If it's something that you're allowed to go to without registering first and so on. So, again, I would encourage that. Get involved in the sort of local stuff that's going on. Get to know the people who are doing it. They will have interesting things to say. Nationally, I mean, I despise the two parties nationally, so, you know, I care much less about that. But Republican or Democrat, right. It doesn't matter. On the local level, you should get to know those folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, as Coyle noted earlier, you know, this, I've got it planned right now as a trilogy of what if episodes. This one was what if the two big parties went away from public primaries. The next one is going to be what if. A constitutional amendment was ratified to abolish the Electoral College. This is one that is definitely a hot conversation, has been for a number of years, even before the Trump era. And I'll be interested to pick Coyle's brain about that next time we record. Now, next time, because Coyle's and my schedules are very full in June, we'll likely come to you sometime in July. So, you know, don't unsubscribe because we haven't posted in a few weeks. Of course, if you're listening to this, you didn't unsubscribe and we didn't post for a few months. So thank you for that. But Coyle, do you want to close the episode?
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway,